My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's good to be here. Officially, this is a step two meeting. We'll see how that works out. I'll probably mention step two. There, I've done it. You can go home now. I'm going to read it home. Giving a talk at some convention somewhere, I'm using this as an example, but it can it applies. You know, my experience tells me it applies wherever I talk. It's just the principle. And I don't know, it was like any other talk that I give you here or someplace else. And after the meeting, there's invariably, very nice, a group of people that will come up or talk to you and tell you they appreciated it. So this was no different. And there was quite a few people came up and wanted to share with me or talk to me. And, it's a real, not only a privilege to do this, but it's a real, get a lot of satisfaction of meeting people and talking to people, and every person who talked to me about whatever the talk was, would say it was like an hour talk, but everybody who would talk to me about what they got out of the talk wanted to talk to me about one thing they heard in the talk. And so I talked to about 20, 30 people after the meeting. They all talked to me about this one thing that they really got out of the talk, and they all talked about different things. And about 80 of the things they were talking about what I said, I didn't actually say. But it really doesn't matter, because it has really very little to do with me. I was just up there trying to do the best I could with what I got, and they were using whatever their experience was and whatever they're looking for, and with God helping stir that pot, they got out of it what they were supposed to get out of it. But what I understand is, I used to think of these steps, and there's nothing wrong with this. I'm not criticizing it. It's perfectly okay. And I used to do it myself, because I'm sober almost 29 years. And the last almost three decades, I've changed the way I've done these steps. And certainly when I first did them, having studied the material, and wanting to do everything right, and being nervous, and still, for many years, concerned about what other people think about me, wanting to do the perfect, if you want to do the perfect four-step, the perfect, I want to do the perfect meeting, I'd make sure to read up on the step beforehand, and I'd make sure I sort of understood it, and try to understand all the nooks and crannies of the step, and sort of keep on the step, and sort of really formally talk about how you do the step, and it was like a real step two. I'm telling you, it was so step two. There wasn't a step. It didn't even cross over to accidentally touching step three. You know, God forbid it would have even applied to be like a little step one. You know? I mean, it would be sanitized from any other possible step. As a matter of fact, if you got anything else out of it from step two, there's something wrong with you. It was so perfectly step two. Talk about tolerance and open-mindedness and stuff like that. Yeah. But here, what the bottom line is, that's where I was. That was my experience, and that's who I was at 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, whatever it is. You know, as time went on, and instead of actually doing the steps, and I've done the steps over and over and over again, I've done it formally, I've done, oh, I got to do a step 10, I got to do a step 9, and It became not so much, and I think it's a natural thing. You know, they talk about in step 11, it says we get involved in inspirational thinking. At first it's unusual, and then it says we come to rely upon it. I found myself less doing the steps, or working the steps. You know, I gotta work the steps, as living the steps. I was doing the steps, but it wasn't that I was doing the steps, I was just doing what I always do. I was thinking the way I always think. I was acting the way I always act. I was just feeling the way I always feel. And whereas I lived the life before I came in here, and for a great deal of time after I came in here, you know, my feelings, my emotions, my perceptions, before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, were the feelings, emotions, and perceptions of an active alcoholic, which you all are familiar with. You understand? You know, we say things like, they have no idea who they're screwing with. Or they don't know who I am. Or who do you think you're talking to? Or why does this always happen to me? You know? I mean, you know, you say all sorts of things, you know, if you're, and you have all sorts of feelings and all sorts of emotions and perceptions, you know. And I guess it's pretty much summed up in our literature when it talks about what's really wrong with us, which isn't the alcohol. The alcohol is really the solution to our problem. We drink alcohol, you know, I drank alcohol because no suit of clothes, no woman, no car, no amount of money ever worked just quite as well as just a few drinks. So I drank it. You know, if alcohol did for you what it did for me, you'd drink it too. You wouldn't stop. Because my problem was that, like it says in the book, men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They're restless, irritable, discontented, unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And so that's why I drank. I drank because I hated staying sober. I hated sobriety. I would never say that because, you know, you don't have that kind of self-awareness. I hate sobriety. But it says men and women drink because they like the effect, they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort. You know, you can always throw an alcoholic, they're always moving. Even if they're not moving, there's something playing, or they got the phones on, or they got the TV, or the telephone. There's always something going. Anything and everything to distract us from just being. Just being. You know, I think probably more than anything else, you know, when I was a kid, they used to spank you. But somewhere along the line, they started with this thing called timeout. I think for an alcoholic, timeout is far worse than spanking. Timeout has got to be the pits. What do I do? Nothing. You do nothing. You just sit in the corner. Spank me, kill me, shoot me. Just don't force me to sit in the corner doing nothing. Being alone with my thoughts, because my thoughts were bad thoughts about myself and other people. They made me uncomfortable. Give me a drink. So I started, what happened is, and they say, you know, we change. I mean, I should hope so. You know, you look at those promises, you know, new freedom, new happiness, no matter how far down we see how, you know, our experience can affect others. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. All sorts of great things happen. We lose fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. You know, we stop worrying about our little plans and designs. It says in the big book that selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-pity, and self-centeredness. We step on the toes. You know, that's the idea of constantly thinking about yourself. You know, just constantly always me, 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 me. Wake up in the morning, me, 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 me. In the afternoon, me, 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 me. At nighttime, me, 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 me. So you go to sleep, wake up next morning, start all over again, me, 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 me. Can't get rid of me, can't stop thinking about me. What's going to happen to me? What's this going to do to me? Why is he looking at me? Why is this happening to me? You know, what's going to happen? You know, it's all about me, 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 me. Chock full of me. Just anything to get rid of me, you know, and nothing seems to work, and you can't stop it. And so, somewhere along the line when I started developing or being transformed, because they say in the big book, when Dr. Young was talking to Roland Hazard, he said, ideas, emotions, and the attitudes, which are the driving point of these men's lives, you know, they get pushed to the side and they become dominated by a whole new set of emotions and attitudes. You see this in old timers in AA, I think. Some old timers, the ones that I looked up to. Thank God they're all old timers. Thank God everybody doesn't have 3 months. That's all I can say. Hey, nothing against 90 days here, you know, but thank God there were guys that just, I was an old, you know, we don't put people on pedestals, but you know something, we do. You know, we do. It's human nature. You know, it's, you know, I mean, God is important in my life, and I have faith in God now, but the fact of the matter is, if it wasn't for other humans that I thought were gods, even though it says, you know, other person, people can, if it wasn't for other, it doesn't say in the book, if you want, listen, it said the step before, it's the step, there's a step before the step. It says, if you want Here's what it says. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Before the steps, it says you're ready if you want what we have, which means you got to have a we. You got to have somebody or something you're looking at that you say, man, I wish I could be like him. Now, that's not necessarily hero worship, or it might be. It might not. It's not it's whatever. What it's like, it's something. It's seeing something in somebody else. I know now it's how God transforms somebody else, because this is a program of attraction. That you say, I don't know what that guy has, but he has something that I think a person ought to have. It has something that I have. I don't quite understand it. I don't know how you get it, but I wish I could be like he is. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, it's probably said as good as it could be said. When Bill Dodson wrote his testimony, it's right after, you know, that's why these testimonies, these stories are so important, because you read them and say, man, I wish I could have what that guy had, because it's a personal testimony. But this is what he said. Bill Dodson was sitting at his kitchen table. He had 2 weeks sobriety. He was looking at Bill Wilson, and he said, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed, this is what he says, it wasn't an intellectual thing. So many people try to make an intellectual thing out of this thing. You know, you go into treatment, nothing wrong with treatment, but you know what the problem with treatment is? It's all intellectual. It's all do step 4, do step 3, do step 2, get a sponsor. It's all this intellectual stuff. Like somehow you're going to solve this thing with your brain. You're going to figure it out, or it's some sort of test, or it's like a school exam, or it's like a course you take. And when really the driving force of this is desire. It's desire. You know, I can teach you a lot of stuff, but I can't, you know, you can't teach somebody desire. You can teach somebody how to play golf. You can teach somebody how to fish, but you can't teach them to desire to win, to desire that stuff, to want this so bad. How do you teach desire? How do you learn desire in it? How do you learn desire in treatment? The only way I learned desire, I know what desperation is. Desperation will help to a certain degree. Desperation will get you into the rooms. But the way I learned desire is I didn't learn desire until I ran into other people. I had to look, feel, touch before I desired. I had to see other people. I had to get next to sponsors. And other people were talking where I said, gee, I wish, it's that thing, it's an emotional thing. It's a spiritual thing that you wish you had something. It's not something that can be intellectually learned. It's an ingredient that somehow you either got it or you don't. You know, I don't understand why it is, but it just is. Why you could have 100 people in the AA room, and 20 of them could be looking at the speaker and said, man, I wish I could do what he or she does and had what she had. And you have 20 people saying, I want to get out of here. Who needs this shit? But I know that that makes all the difference between sobriety, long-term sobriety, and not. I see, that's what I know. And you can't legislate that. You can't force somebody to have that deal, that desire. This guy had that desire. This is the way he put it. He said, it would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed, this is the first thing he says, I noticed that others seem to have such a release, a happiness, a something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. Since I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful they had been released from this terrible thing. And he had given God the credit for having done it, and he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it, has been a sort of golden text for AA program and for me. You know, that when you're an alcoholic and you're all over the place, drunk or sober, you're just nuts. And you don't have a clue. You are clueless as to who or what you are or why you're even on the planet. You're running around hither and yon, You know, maybe it's sex, maybe it's money, maybe it's cars, running all over the place, and nothing, nothing satisfies you for any more than a nanosecond. And you're hovering somewhere between incredible excitement and wanting to put a gun in your mouth and blow your brains out. Over a period of time, all mixed up with booze and drugs. And you run into some character that had the disease you had, or is about as crazy as you are, and he's got his act together. You know when somebody's got their act together. Because they're not nuts. And they're stable. You know, some of us are attracted to that. That's why there's a program of attraction rather than promotion. You know, we want that stuff. And so in any event, I want to read this. Going with that, I want to read this poem. It's called The Guy in the Glass. It was written in 1934, the year before AA came into being. You know, and AA started in 1935. It says, The Guy in the Glass says, by the way, the word, they use a word in here called PELF, P-E-L-F, which means stuff, things, like money, you know, stuff like that. When you get what you want in your struggle for PELF and the world makes you king for a day, then go to the mirror and look at yourself and see what that guy has to say. For it isn't your father or mother or wife whose judgment upon you must pass, for the fellow whose verdict counts most in your life is the guy staring back in the glass. He's the fellow to please, now remind all the rest, for he's with you clear up to the end. And you've passed your most dangerous, difficult test if the guy in the glass is your friend. You may be like Jack Horner and chisel a plum and think you're a wonderful guy, but the man in the glass says you're only a bum if you can't look him straight in the eye. You can fool the whole world down the pathway of years and get pats on the back as you pass, but your final reward will be heartache and tears if you cheated the guy in the glass. You know, and I don't know about you, but when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, or before I actually hit the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought my life was over. And they talk about hitting bottom. I'm not sure what hitting bottom is, but I know I thought my life was over, and it was never going to get better again. You know, they say the chief characteristic of alcoholics in chapter 3 of the book is defiance. It says that the chief characteristic of all alcoholics is defiance. We're selfish, we're self-centered, we're always thinking about ourselves. I don't know about you, but the truth of the matter is I'll tell you, maybe I'm exaggerating this. Maybe I'm making it worse than it is. I really don't think so. And I don't think I was an evil guy. I don't think I was like pure evil or anything like that. But the truth of the matter is, the only person I ever really cared about was myself. I mean, if I'm gonna be honest with you, I never gave a crap about anybody except myself. You know, we have this little thing I hear in AA here once in a while, and maybe I just take it differently. They say, well, you can't love anybody unless you love yourself first. You know, like that's some sort of axiom. Maybe it's true. Maybe they're talking about a different type of love or whatever thing, but nobody was a bigger fan of me than I was my biggest fan. Trust me. Nobody excused my actions more than me. Nobody felt I should get away with stuff more than me. Nobody wanted me to win more than me. Nobody thought more about me than me. Believe me, I could give a damn about you. I was always going to be number one. I am the biggest thought on my mind all the time. And that doesn't necessarily stop the moment you hit the doors of AA and the booze goes away. That may sort of like start slowing down about 15 or 20 years later. You understand what I'm saying? Even after AA, it's all me, 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 fueled by what? Sex and relationships and stuff, which doesn't slow that stuff down. It just makes it go faster. This stuff is designed to be the speed bump to that. That ego deflation to slow this stuff down. It says selfishness, self-centeredness. It says we must get rid of this. We must or it kills us. And then you know what it says right after that? It says God makes that possible. It doesn't say a girlfriend makes that possible. It doesn't say a boyfriend doesn't make that possible. It doesn't say a lot of money or a job makes that possible. It says God makes that possible. That's what our literature says. Now, of course, we all walk in here with the notion that the real solution to our problem is a lot of money and a new car and a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend. But that's not what AA is about. That's not what we're about in here. At least the ones that hang on for a long period of time. So in any event, after a while, as I kept on doing these things and the transformation happened, what I noticed is not only did my perception about things change, and the way I looked at things changed, and the way I acted changed, and the way I felt about myself. Did I do something there?
Your battery's out.
My battery's out. It's been a long time out, trust me. Listen, thank God. I almost died out there when my battery was on. But anyway, man, I'll wait for you.
Sorry about that.
Thank you, no problem. So what happened was I noticed about myself is this stuff started being such a chore and such a battle. You know, it was hand-to-hand combat with the world, trying to figure out how to do this thing and all this stuff, where all of a sudden it started coming naturally to me. And where I used to say things like, oh, I have to do a step 10 on this, or a step 3 on this, or I got to turn this over, or not. I didn't have to turn it over. I didn't have to, well, you ought to turn that over. You ought to let go, let God. You know what I mean? First things first. I wasn't turning it over. I wasn't letting go and letting God. You know, I was just doing it. I wasn't turning it over. I was just turning it over. I wasn't doing anything. I was just doing what I always do. The way I always think. And it didn't become something, it didn't become like a step anymore. It was just, you know, it was just the way I live. It's just the way I live. It's just the way I think. So I went from somebody who was always noticing all the crap that was going on and all the blemishes to somebody that really wasn't noticing a whole lot of anything that was going on. And I went from somebody who for the most part, nobody reaches perfection here. I don't want to indicate that. But I went from somebody who was constantly thinking, the mind was constantly going with a million different voices, to the incredible gift of being able to live life without doing a whole bunch of thinking. There's not much really you have to think about in order to go from point to point. So in any event, as I started doing the step, what I realized is as I started working these steps and going through my life day to day, that the steps were really incorporated, were all mushed together, they're incorporated in everything I do in my life. And if I look at you and listen to you for a half an hour or 15 minutes, I can see steps or non-steps or things and everything you're saying and everything you're doing. It's just, if I want to start analyzing and looking at it. And so what I understand about step meetings or meetings or whatever you say when people are sharing honestly from their heart is that if, you know, Bill Wilson said if you want, what I started realizing is that this book is the truth. Now, how about that? This book speaks the truth. Everything in this book is the truth. It's the absolute truth. And what I realized is what Bill Wilson said is I found that when you want God enough, he appears. And he gives you what you need. It may not even be what you want. He gives you what you need. And so if somebody comes in here, I don't care whether they're looking for step 2, step 16, or have no idea what they're looking for at all. Or like my friend James was telling me, he came to a meeting I was doing and he was looking to get laid. Which has to do with another step. I understand that. James is here. I sponsored James. You know, he's a good guy. I like James. He's like, I don't want to embarrass him. But he says, you know, I remember I met you. I was at this meeting with this guy. I was trying to get laid. He wasn't looking for the step. He was looking for some action. And he sat there. No problem, James. I wanted to give you some press time. And, but you see, here's the problem. The problem is, notwithstanding what you want, you know, once the words go in, you can no longer predict where that's going to take you. And you may not get step two or step three or step five. You're going to get whatever you're going to get or not get or whatever it is. It's just going to happen. And one of the things I understand about this entire deal, which not only has to do with step two, it has to do with every single step. Mostly we talk about it in step seven, and I will talk about it in step seven, but it has a great deal to do with step two. And that's the concept of something called humility. Now, humility, you know, you could look it up in the dictionary. I did look it up in the dictionary, and I found a couple definitions. One definition was, well, when you're humble, you don't feel you have to prove anything then. Listen, I'm the last guy who could talk about humility. I'm an expert on arrogance. I'm being a know-it-all, I don't know anything about humility, but when I looked it up, I had a look at it, it said when you're a person who's humble, you know, somebody told me the joke where he says, you know, humility is a real weird, I don't even know what you can do. How do you do humility? You wake up in the morning and says, well, I think I'll be humble today. You know, I mean, you've already lost it. You know, if they give you the award, well, I'm going to give Russell the award on humility. So you stand up and get the award. You lost it. You know what I mean? You can't do it. You can't do humility. As a matter of fact, I think people who are humble don't even know they're humble. They don't even know they're humble. If you think you're humble, you're not. The only people who are humble are people who don't even know they are. They have it. I mean, what's the use? What's the point? And you notice, here's what it says in step seven. It says, the ingredient of humility is absolutely necessary in order to have sobriety in step seven. And he goes on to say, the attainment of more humility is really the touchstone to get where we have to go. And listen, I don't know what humility is, but I know this. If you're an alcoholic, you don't have it. And you don't even know how to get it. And you're not even sure you want it, because it has something to do with humiliation. And it does. And it doesn't sound... I just don't remember ever... I don't even remember a pickup line that had anything to do with humility. I don't remember anybody talking in a bar about humility. I don't remember, prior to coming to AA, having any conversation, anytime, anywhere, with anybody, even in school, where we used the word humble. It was like a bad word. And this is like the touchstone here. And, you know, one of the things about humility is it's having a clear conception of who and what you really are. You know, I mean, here, my conception of me is I am either the greatest thing in the entire universe, better than anybody, deserving of everything, or the worst piece of shit. It's either if I'm the best, when I'm the best, which is when I have all the money in the bank, when I'm on top of the world and I'm the best, trust me, you don't even want to be around me because everybody's suffering. And when I'm the worst, which is when I'm the worst? When I'm not the best. That's the way it works with me. You know what I mean? There's like two speeds. There's two speeds. Best, worst. There's no in between, you know? Saturday night with a girl, best. Saturday night without the girl, worst. You know, there's no like a middle deal. You know what I mean? Sure, you guys are laughing. You know what it's like. But when I'm the worst, then everything affects me. Then I'm sensitive and everything affects me. That's sort of like trying to figure out where I am. And then I learned later on in the 12 and 12, it says, how do we get a new perception? Through 100 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. It says every newcomer learns that his humble admission of powerlessness is the first step. And then I learned where we come to realize the value of suffering. It talks about me and says, all my life, all I've been doing is running from pain, running from problems, trying to avoid difficulties, doing anything so as not to get hurt, pushing anybody, hurting anybody, slapping anybody, lying, cheating, stealing, drinking, doing anything to avoid pain or suffering or uncomfortability or embarrassment or humiliation. And of course, I'm thinking, yeah, what's your point? Yeah, right. I mean, you got another way? He says, yeah, embrace that shit. That's like good stuff. When you're being crushed, that's great stuff. And then, of course, you learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you've been here for a while, that whether you think being crushed and being humiliated and being pushed down and slapped around and having your ego deflated, whether you like it or not, you need to really get used to it, because that's the way of the warrior in here. Because if you're going to stay sober in here, you cannot stay sober to good purpose and get what they have, what you want, unless you're willing to walk down that road. And unless you're ultimately willing to not only walk down it, but walk down it being grateful for being crushed and understanding that deal. And understanding that deal. And I got to tell you something, there's a whole big difference in living life on the planet when instead of running from pain or worrying about pain, you embrace pain and you embrace suffering and you stop fearing it. I'll tell you what, you know, as you all know, I'm a great believer in this doesn't mean you have to be this, you know, I mean, as you know, I talk a lot about God and I happen to be a Christian and I do a lot of Bible study as they did in AA, and that's something, some transformation that happened to me. And one of the greatest lines, and I love this line because it's in AA, it's all over our program, is the last line that Jesus said before he allegedly left the planet. Now you figure the last line's got to be a good one. I mean, you got a book called the Bible that's been used, whether you like it or not, whether you believe it or not, it was read for 4 years by our fellowship before they came in here. I'll read you something out of Dr. Bob's Good Old Time, says it forms the whole basis. Hundreds of millions of people read it. It's caused also some of the most brilliant people in the world. It's a book written over thousands of years by many people, you know, and you know, and you figure the last line's got to be the biggest one. You figure, what could be the last line? Last line he says before he leaves. The last line. Imagine saying, what's the last line? Biggest guy to be, it's like, see you around, guys. I'll be back, you know. You know the last line he said? Last line in the Bible. Before he said adios, and that's it. Last time he says, you know what he said to his disciples? He didn't say, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. He didn't say, don't worry, everything's going to be okay. This is what he said. He says, in this world, you will have problems. Hey, listen, let me tell you something. In this world, you will have problems. That's the truth. But this is what he said. He says, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. And you know when he said that, you know what he meant? If you read a little bit before, the reason he said be of good cheer, because he was trying this, what he was saying is, he says, if I can do it, you can too. You can get to a world not without problems, but where there is problems, but they can't even touch you. They can't even touch you. You ever listen to a newcomer in AA? You ever listen to a newcomer in AA? Forget about a newcomer. Somebody with 5 years, 10 years. You know, what do they want to talk to you about? They say, and this happened, and that happened, and then she did this, and then she, it's just a vomiting forward, nonstop, of everything that happened to him that day, 16 years ago, 50, I mean, you need a program to follow him. And then this happened, and then happened, and she said this, and she said that. I mean, everything is like a big melodrama. It's a life filled with melodrama about what? About me. Let me tell you what happened to me. This is what's happening to me. And then when you get bored and you leave, they go find another victim. Listen, let me tell you, it's not only me. It's finding as many victims that they can wrap around themselves to get attention. It's an insatiable desire to bounce me off for as many people as I can possibly do. So gotta get everybody else interested in the drama. And it's a compulsion. It's like an addiction. I can't stop it. As a matter of fact, if you try to stop me, like if you're a sponsor, you try to stop me from doing that, I get mad. It's my right. Everybody should be thinking about me like, about me. Should be talking about me. God forbid you actually try to, you ever try to give them a solution? Why don't you just do this? I can't do this. No matter what you tell them, they say, I can't do that. They want to stay right there in the drama. Can you imagine living another type of life where you're not even in the drama? There ain't no drama. Because the world's not touching you. And that's what this book is all about. I remember when I first spoke to my sponsor, not when I first spoke to him, but Joe Snyder, and several of my sponsors told me this, but the one I remember the best is when I called him up on the phone to complain to him. I was had 7 years, and I was complaining to him about my wife. And she did this, and she did that, and she did this, and she did that, and I did about 20 minutes of vomiting all over him and about what she did. It was terrible. had something to do with saying something or spending something or doing something, or it's outrageous. And he said, well, you understand why you're upset, don't you? And I said, sure, I know why I'm upset. And he says, well, why are you upset? I said, what do you mean, Joe? I just, 20 minutes, I just told you in detail what she did. She did this, and he did that, and she did this, and he did that. And he said, that's not why you're upset. I said, what do you mean, that's not why I'm upset? He says, that's not why you're upset. I said, that's not why I'm upset. She said this, and she did that, and she did this. He said, you're telling me that's not why I'm upset? He says, no, that's not why you're upset. And he shut up. Shut up. He didn't say a word. He didn't say, you want to know why you're upset? He didn't say anything like that. He just shut up. Because he knew, I'm an alcoholic. I'm full of defiance. If he had told me why I was upset, I said, that's a bunch of bullshit. He made me ask. You know, you can't help somebody unless they need help, they want help, and they ask for help. Never mistake somebody who needs help and wants help for somebody that's actually asking for help. Big difference between needing help. Everybody needs help. Not everybody wants help. Very, 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 very few people will ever in AA ask you for help. Because to ask another human being for help requires something that most alcoholics don't have. It requires something called humility. You can have people that come in all over the place and say, man, that guy really needs help, but he'll never ask you for help. He'll ask you for a dollar. He'll ask you for, but he won't ask you for help. Asking for help requires a whole lot of other, requires something else. Requires something called humility, which is something that's in poor supply around here and with me, that's for sure. So he said, that's not why you're upset. So then he was silent. And so I thought, I said, well, are you going to tell me why I'm upset? And then he said, of course, well, do you really want to know? I said, yeah, why I'm upset? He says, listen, stupid. He says, you're upset because you're upsettable. You know, if you understand the corollary, that's the same thing Jesus was saying. I was upset because I was allowing the world to touch me, because it had something to do with me and how I was affected by stuff in the world. And now, I'm not saying I never get upset. I'm not saying it never happens. But now, my wife probably does the same stuff all the time. Doesn't change that much. She's probably done the same thing. I have guys that I sponsor say, did you hear what she said? I said, what? I don't even notice it. In this world, you'll have wives. You'll have husbands. Be of good cheer. I've overcome the wife. I've overcome the wife. Did you hear what your wife said? What? Did you say something? You know? My wife used to say, you're the worst husband. What do you mean I'm the worst husband? You're the worst. What do you mean I'm the worst? Look what I did to you. Look what I did. Now she says, you're the worst husband. I said, probably right. No question about it. I've seen husbands. I'm pretty bad. I just plead guilty. I say, can we go right to the sentencing? And just tell me what the fine is. I could probably afford it. I used to hire the lawyer and go to trial, and the trial was killing me. I just plead guilty. I plead guilty, no contest, whatever it is, go right to the fine. How much is this going to cost? Now listen, it takes humility to plead guilty even when you're not. You know? Sometimes you got to plead guilty, they won't even accept a no contest plea. You're right. So I was, so when I was about 15 years sober, I was driving in my car, and I, around when I was 15 years or 16 years, I don't know what it was, when I around 14, 15 years, somebody tapped me on the shoulder and asked me whether I studied the Bible, because I had been reading all the big books, and I read Sermon on the Mount, which was something that the founders read a lot of, and it was one of the favorite books, that and in Corinthians, and of course the book of James, which is a big the book with the sponsors. And I was so much in, I was sponsored by people that were into the books that the founders were reading, that I read a lot about the Bible and stuff like that, and different commentaries on that stuff, and it helped me out tremendously. A guy came up to me who wasn't in the fellowship, and he asked me whether I'd ever been to a Bible study, and I said, I'm not going to do a Bible study. I'm going to Bible study. I'm an AA, you know. And I was about to say no, but I had reached a point in time in my life when I was 15 years sober, but somehow, instinctively, I knew that the reason I was saying no, you know, see, God, you know, there's a poem called The Road Less Traveled that I read once, and I won't read it here. Roland, it says, you know, two roads diverge in a wood, and you whatever, you're gonna be hitting parts of your life where there are gonna be people that come up to you or approach you. Bob Earl calls them Eskimos. These guys are coming out of the blue. You've never met them before, and they're going to tap you on the shoulder. They're going to say, why don't you go here instead of there? Have you ever done this? And they're going to present you with options in your life where you can go somewhere or meet somebody or do something that you would have never done had you not met these people. And you're going to react to them somehow. And what road you choose, whether you choose to go down that road or not go down that road, is going to make a difference between whether you drink or not drink. It's going to make a difference between, it's going to make a difference 20 years down the road as to who you are and what you are. It's going to make a big difference in your life. It's going to lead you on to other people and other things, for good or for bad. And what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, instinctively, is that for the most part, when I make decisions because of fear. See, a lot of people don't understand. They don't even analyze their decisions. They don't even think about their decisions. You know? I can't stand that woman. Will you marry me? You know, I mean, you don't even know why they did it. They just meet somebody to marry them. They go out with them. They get engaged. Next thing you know, they're 20 years down the road. Why did I marry this woman? Why did I take this job? You know what I mean? What am I, you know, they don't really think. It's like they're living life on automatic pilots, just doing things compulsively. Just making decisions and choosing and just moving, thinking that they're being free, but they're not free at all. They're making decisions and doing things and going places they don't even know because they're driven by some sort of compulsion to do something, be something. And down the road when they look back, they say, why did I do that thing? What was I thinking? Because they weren't. It's sort of like a non-thinking. And so I was about to say no because I've never been to a Bible study. And I don't go to Bible study. And that's something I've never done before. And I've never done it before, and I'm never going to do it, you know. So I was about to say no because I was what? Because I knew it. Because I was scared. Because I was scared. You see, before I came today, I'd never admit I was scared or I was fearful. I was, oh, I'm concerned. I'm anxious, you know. I don't feel good. I feel uncomfortable. You know what I mean? It's just because I was scared. But see, I knew that there was really no reason not to do it. I trusted God. I was scared. So I said, yes. I found myself saying, yes. Sort of like sometimes you say, you want to go to AA? You say, yes. You know, you go, yes. Why did I say it? And you wind up, it's the greatest thing you ever did. You're about to say no, but you said yes. How many people do you see come to AA meetings and say, I wasn't even coming here tonight, and I was going to go someplace else? I don't know, I'm here. You know, you just say yes. And so I said, yes, so I went to this Bible study, and I really enjoyed it, and I liked it, and I got a lot out of it, and they were talking about the same stuff I talked about at AA meetings. And I came back the next week, and the guy who invited me there never showed up again. And I've been going there now for 15 years, straight, every Thursday. It's men's Bible study. I'm studying the Bible. So in any event, so I was driving around this day, a particular day, and I always have books in my car. You know, you can see I got three or four big books, and I got Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and 12 and 12s and Bibles. I got about 15 Bibles in my car and they're in my trunk and everything. It's all over the place, strewn all over the place. And I'd be driving up to this thing called Pierre's Cleaners, which you can see my house from Pierre's Cleaners. If you're at Pierre's Cleaners, I can point, you see that roof? That's my house, you know? And I drive with Pierre's Cleaners and this guy, this is a true story, I'm 15 years sober, comes out of the door. He's about 17 years old, 16, 17 years old. And he's like talking, I can't explain it. First of all, I saw something I'd never seen before. Now this is like 10 years ago. His pants, I don't even know how to explain this. Somebody can explain this to me. The waist, you know how my waist is right here? The waist of his pants were above his knees. I can't explain this. The belt, do you even understand what I'm talking about? I'm not kidding you here. His belt was about 3 inches above his knees. I didn't even know what was keeping it up, you know what I mean? And he was talking like this. I don't know whether he was disfigured or whatever. He said, hey, you know? As a matter, he pointed. I happen to have a Bible, a big red Bible, in the front of my car, and he pointed at the Bible, but he didn't point like this. He said, "I got one of those." He's like pointing, and I said, "One of what?" He says, "One of those." And he says, and I said, "Is that for me?" He said, "I said, oh, you mean a Bible?" And he said, "Yeah, a Bible." And I said, "Well, you ever read it?" He says, "Yeah, I read it." He says, "You like it?" He says, "Yeah, I like it." I said, "Well, you ever do a Bible study?" You know, I listen. You know, one of the wonderful things about being in this program and going through what you go through is I don't. I used to use AA as like a coffin, you know, like you nail yourself in the, like it's all AA, there's AA people and the earth people, you know, and stuff like that. You know what I learned? I learned what they talk about in AA and the family afterwards, about where they encourage church membership. I learned that there are millions of people out there that we don't have the corner on either righteousness or on spiritual development. There's millions of people out there that are walking the path we're walking, and I can go to a million AA meetings and connect with millions of people. I can be in an AA meeting the entire day with people that don't even have medallions in their pocket. I don't have to feel like this is the only place. It's all out there, as long as I'm able to connect with these people. And then instead, AA is not a coffin, it's really a launching pad for me. You know, rock doesn't say we've experienced much of heaven, been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. It's supposed to be of maximum purpose to God and other people. You know, sometimes the people you're effective with and that you help are an alcoholic. So I said, "You ever do a Bible study?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Listen to me." It was Wednesday. I said, "Look, you see that's my house over here. You see that over here?" He says, "At 7:15 tomorrow morning, I'm walking out of that house. If you're there, I'll take you to a men's Bible study." He says, "You will?" He says, "Absolutely." So that was the end. I left. And quite frankly, I forgot all about the guy's kid's name was Leo. I forgot all about him. And the next morning, I wake up and I get up and I walk out the door and I got my Bible under my arm and I walk out, and who do you think's standing by my car but Leo, with the pants and the whole bit, and a Bible. So I remembered, I had spoken to the kid, I said, "Well, come on, get in." So we drive down to the deal, we go to the Bible study, he sat there. You know, most of the guys in the Bible study, you know, that I go to, they're like about 20 years old. I mean, these are guys that have been studying the Bible for like 50 years. I mean, these guys, like, they're all, like, in the 90s and 80s. You know, I'm 60. I'm, like, the youngest guy there, you know. And they were happy to see anything that didn't have a pacemaker, you know. And they're talking about and studying the same stuff we're talking about here. And so we went around. We did the whole thing with the Bible study. And at the very end, he said one thing. He raised his hand. He says, "I think Jesus was an alien or something like that, from Mars or something." And, you know, I waited to see how these guys would react. You know, I love these guys. And, you know, what do you think they did? They did what we do. They said, "Hey, great kid. Yeah, keep coming back. It was great seeing you." And I just loved on them, you know what I mean? Because that's what they are. Because they practice what they preach. They don't judge or hurt people. They're just filled with love. They understand that the whole thing is about love. You know, they understood who he was and what he was. And they just loved on the kid. They were just happy to see him. So we're driving back. And the kid, you know, of course, he says, "What do you think?" He says, "Oh, they loved you. They loved you, kid. You know, it was great." He says, "Would you do me a favor?" He said, "Do you think, instead of dropping me off at your house, you could take me to my house?" I said, "Sure." I said, "How do I get there?" He says, "Well, drive, make a righty, go back to your house, and I'll show you." So I went back to my house. He says, "Now, keep on going down to the corner." So I went down to the corner. He says, "Then make a right on," so I made a right on the line. And, you know, as I'm driving, I'm learning about this kid. I'm learning he's like around 16, 17 years old. And his mother's a single mother, and he has a little daughter. He has a sister, a little daughter. She's about 3 years old from another guy, you know, and there's no man in his life. His mother's dating some guy, but he's a young, he's like a 16, 17 year old kid, you know, all alone except for his mother, who's like a waitress or something like that, just trying to make his way, trying to figure out what the deal is. No man in his life or anything like that. No father or anything like that. Hasn't had one for a long time. And he's just a young kid, a good kid, just trying to figure out what the hell's going on. And so he said, "Well, go down there and go down here and go down here." Next thing I know, I'm like 6-7 miles away from my house. And he says, "Okay, pull in here." And that's my thing. So I get out and I said, "Hey, it's good to see you. And I hope you come back." And so I said to him, I says, "Well, how'd you get down here in the first place?" He says, "I walked." And what I learned is he got up at 3:30 in the morning. Oh, got up at 3:30 in the morning and walked to my house and got there a half an hour, 45 minutes early, because he wanted to make sure that he didn't miss me. Now, you see, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I used to say, when I looked that guy in the eye, and I looked at him and I said, I looked at this man and I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. I looked at him in the eye and said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. I used to think that was when I hit bottom. That wasn't when I hit bottom. That was all about the second step for me. See, asking for help is all about the second step for me. You hear a lot of talk. You know, I see guys, they come in, they say, well, I slipped again, and I slid again, and will you be my sponsor? And they proceed to tell me what they think they need to do. Or order me, when are we going to work the steps? Or this is what I think I'm missing. Or they're telling me how they're going to get sober. Or they're telling me about how they're going to do the 90-90. Or they're telling me what they're going to do. See a lot of people telling people what they're going to do or how they're going to do it. Let me tell you something. Few and far between is the person will say, will you help me? And then shuts up and listens. I was on the AA hotline for Dade County for 8 years. If you called the Bay on Friday night from 11 o'clock till 8 in the morning, you got me, which is probably why nobody stayed sober, got sober for a period of time. You know, I had a lot of people call me up at 1 o'clock in the morning and talk to me for 3 hours about their life and how they felt about things and their opinions about stuff. I had a lot of people tell me what they thought their problems were and everything. And I hung on the phone. I don't know whether I helped any of those people or any of those people got help, but I would hang on the phone there because once in a while, once in a blue moon, 1 out of 50, I would get a call like this. The guy would call up, and this, or the guy would call up and say, he says, I can't stop drinking, I need help, and then they would shut up. Very rarely does an alcoholic shut up. They would shut up. And you know why they shut up? Because they were waiting to hear what I had to say. Because they wanted to know, they weren't waiting to talk. They didn't want me to listen to them. They didn't give me the scrap. You gotta listen to me. You gotta listen to my story. They used to get upset when I'd say, no, I don't. I don't have to. You know. And they would say, I need help. And they'd say, what do I do? And they would listen. I'd say, this is where you go. And sometimes I'd say, I'll meet you there, or something like that. You know, that, I need help. What should I do? I need help. I can't stop drinking. That deal. That's all part of the second step. If you think about it, asking another person for help is all about reaching out to something beyond yourself and saying, I can't do it, I'm powerless, I need help, there's something out there that can restore me to sanity. Although, otherwise, why would you even ask? And you know what happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous? We get way too well too fast, don't we? We come in here unemployable, you know, 3 months later we're underpaid. We're telling everybody how to run the deal. You know, don't take my inventory, you know. How do you keep that not only that desire that kid had, Leo, how do you keep that humility where you're listening? Now for me, you know, part of it is being pounded. If you're lucky, you'll get pounded. God help the alcoholic that gets all the money and gets everything he wants. He's out of here. He's gone. I feel sorry for the guy. You know, you might look at him, you may envy him. Don't envy him. He'll never grow up. Growing up, you know, if you know, hey, God love you. The best thing God did for me is just crush me and keep me down. That's the only leash he has on me, you know, while I learn and while I mature and while I get better. And part of it is really who you surround yourself with. I always want to surround myself with people that I'm in awe of. I always want to surround myself with people that have something that I don't want. Just like that guy was talking about, that man on the bed, that's Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, that guy, when he said, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. You know, the guy who was looking at him, he said, he was looking at Bill Wilson in awe, because he knew that Bill Wilson had something he hadn't got, and he was willing to watch him and listen to him to try to figure out what that was because he wanted it. You know, that guy, the man on the bed. You always want to be in that position where you have people, you know, around you where you're trying to get something they have that you know you haven't got. Now, I don't know how you get to the point where you can get that in somebody. Some people have it, some people don't. Some people, they're just hanging around in here, you know, dry at the moment. Like they say, that young kid in Vision View, dry at the moment, alcohol dry, feel better, look better, have a better time, I don't miss it at all. He smiled, such Sally, We know he will soon try the old game again because he's not happy with his sobriety. He's not happy. He wants to run the roads again. You know, it's just something that some of us are blessed with. It's just a blessing from God. So thank you very much. It's all yours, bud.
Tuesday of the month, which is directly following this meeting tonight. Please see me or any of the other